That was my introduction to my duties as the Chamberlain's assistant. I copied out the food orders and gave them to Georgios. He would have gone off with them, leaving me on my own, if I hadn't followed him out of the alcove and caught him by the flowing sleeve. "Sir," I said, "I need somebody to guide me around. Where do I get food? For that matter, where's the latrine?" Georgios glared at me, but he couldn't pull his tunic away without tearing the fabric. We had an audience, at least a dozen people, watching more or less openly. The Chamberlain pointed at one of them, a boy of 15 or so, and said, "Abram, this is Olfetri. Do whatever he tells you." Abram said, "Suits me," without enthusiasm. He continued to squat on his heels as Georgios swept into the gallery and out of sight. "I want some food," I said to the boy. "While we're eating, I'll have some more questions for you." "Would the food include wine for me?" Abram said, raising an eyebrow. "It could," I agreed. He bounded upright as though he were a toy driven by a spring. His grin was not only alert but friendly. "Willing to take a bit of a walk?" Abram said. "Yes, if there's a reason to," I said, wondering what this was about. "I won't say old Marshall has better food than the refectory here in Georgios's suite," the boy said. "But Marshall's wine is a lot better. He taps the Admiral's own casks, right? Now it'll cost a bit." "I don't have any money," I said. "Well, I'll front you till you start making your own graft," Abram said. "And you're in a bloody good place to do that, it seems to me." We went down a different set of stairs. If anything, they were flimsier than the ones Georgios had led me up. At the bottom we went left and through a door that led outdoors rather than into the courtyard. 30-odd people, men and women both, stood near a kiosk built against the outside wall. We were on the north side of the palace, so there was a strip of shade even now in early afternoon. Abram squeezed up to the counter. There were two servers, both middle-aged women, but Abram shouted, "Hey, Marshal, I want you to meet a friend of mine. Olfetri runs the Chamberlain's computer." The cook turned around. "No fooling," he said. He was a fat man of 50, bald on top but sporting a magnificent mustache and sideburns. His terry-cloth singlet was soaked with sweat, but without any other stains that I could see. "Hey, Aisha, I'm going to take a break. Come on back, Abram." One of the servers took over at the grill. Abram led me under the end of the counter. We ducked. It didn't have a gate to lift, and into a door in the palace wall. It seemed to have been enlarged from a ventilator. The interior was a large storeroom. Marshall twisted two bare wires together. Fluorescence flickered on. He gestured to the low stools along the interior wall. "Will you have wine?" "Do fish piss in the sea?" Abram said. "I'm paying for my friend Olfetri until he gets something going." I took the glass of red wine and tasted it with my tongue. It was good. Good enough that my mother would have approved. Well, she would have approved if anybody but Dad had offered it. Nothing Dad did was good enough. Or anything I did, come to think. "So," Marshall said, settling onto another stool, "do you think you'll be able to earn some money, Olfetri?" "Yes," I said, "and if we're going to be friends, I go by Roy. As for the details, I won't know exactly how until I learn the system here, but..." I shrugged and turned my free hand up. "I can think of half a dozen ways off the top of my head. It shouldn't be hard." I told Captain Leary that I wasn't a crook like my dad, and I wasn't. That didn't mean I didn't know how a system could be fiddled. There was nothing about Georgios or his master, the Admiral, that made me imagine that I owed them loyal service.
"I can find anything you want, Roy," Abram said.
"Say, are you looking for girl?"
"Maybe later," I said. I didn't say that I'd rather meet somebody on my own. "I told you, I need to learn the system."
"That's smart," said Marshall. "Jumping in too quick, you're likely to get trapped," he snorted. "Or clapped."
"Hey, Marshall," Abram said. "You know I wouldn't let him get burned."
To me, in a wheedling tone, he said, "Boys, maybe?"
"No," I said.
"Abram, if I need something, I'll let you know." Someone knocked on the outside door. Abram hopped up and opened it, then returned to us, carrying a tray of hot pasties. He held out the tray to me, but he'd taken one himself with his free hand.
"Which division do you eat in, Roy?" Marshall said.
"The Chamberlain's, I suppose."
"I suppose," I said. "Georgios didn't say, but he said I'm his slave."
Marshall's mouth worked as though he were going to spit in disgust. But what came out was only the words, "Gardain's the cheapest bastard in the palace. I'd as soon drink lamp oil as the wine he serves." I took a careful nibble off the end of a pasty. It was a green vegetable, probably spinach, and very good. It was hot enough that I was glad not to have taken a larger bite, but it made me realize how hungry I was.
"Can I transfer from his division to yours, Marshal?" I asked around another mouthful. I'm not really enrolled yet, after all. No, the bastard won't let you go, the cook said glumly. The losing division has to agree, and Gardein won't. He screws half the per-person allowance in straight profit, and he won't let a soul off his books. Oh, I said. If it's just a matter of getting Master Gardein's agreement, then I can talk to him. I think he'll be reasonable if I ask him the right way. Dream on, buddy, Marshall said. Here, though, another glassful on me. I'll take the wine, I said. But Abram, you and I need to get going soon. I have a lot of work to do, a lot of work. I decided that my first priority was to prepare for my interview with Gardein. I already had some ideas about that. I wasn't a computer expert, but the palace's systems were so unsophisticated that I was sure within a few hours that my only problems were going to be with pre-existing input errors. Nothing was encrypted, but a number of the files were corrupt beyond my ability to clarify. There were areas which had been mechanically blocked. They would require chipped inserts in the unit's present configuration. I figured I had an answer to that, but it could wait until I had the leisure. I found the refectory accounts easily, but it took me and Abram 2 hours to compile the list I wanted. The boy knew more than half the names, but the rest took research. I found a few by searching the computer, but mostly research meant Abram running off and talking to friends. He knew a lot of people in the palace, which didn't surprise me. And at least at the bottom end, people seemed to like him, which didn't surprise me either. When I decided I was ready, I had a much longer list than I'd expected at the start. Now, I said to Abram, lead me to Gardein. Then go do something else. This will work best if it's just me and the cook in private. It shouldn't be a big deal. The Chamberlain's refectory was 5 bays in the south wing of the 3rd floor, just around the corner from Georgios' staff quarters. The first 2 bays off the gallery were given over to tables. A 3rd was the kitchen itself. The remaining 2 were housing and offices. Abram brought me to the last of these and said to the guard, This is the Chamberlain's personal assistant. He needs to talk to Gardein. It isn't time yet for Gardein to see people, the guard said stolidly. Georgios told me that Olfetri goes everywhere, Abram said, which wasn't quite true. Do you want to spend the short rest of your life on a stake because you didn't obey the Chamberlain? This is important. I kept my mouth shut and looked stern. Maybe I could get a uniform. I was wearing spacer slops, comfortable but not very imposing. The palace seemed to be big on appearances. Well, bigger on appearances than society generally. And as I thought about it some more, maybe not that much bigger. Look, said the guard, don't try to put me in the middle of this. It's between the Chamberlain and my boss. Nothing to do with me at all. He stepped out of the way and I walked in, through strings of metal beads hanging down like a curtain. 3 women were in the anteroom, whispering together in a corner. They sprang apart, one of them with an audible, Yip! I pointed to that one. I need to speak with Master Gardein now, I said, in private. You go fetch him, all right? In 1 minute I'll come back and find him if he hasn't made it out here before then. The woman scampered off. All 3 were dressed as maids, young enough to be more than that, but too plain for that to seem probable. The 2 who remained clutched one another's hands and stared at me with a frightened expression. I smiled at them, with what I hoped was a friendly face, and said, I'm new here, but your master and I are going to be great friends shortly. I've just come by to get acquainted. They continued to stare like bunnies in the headlights. At least they weren't screaming. It had been long enough that I was just about to go deeper into the bay, when a man in his 40s came out of the back, still tying a blue gauze sash around his waist. He glared at me and said, If Georgios thinks he's got to see me, he can make an appointment, which meant that the girl I'd sent as a messenger had reported the exchange between Abram and the guard as well as what I'd said. That was a degree of initiative that I hadn't expected. I don't think either one of us wants to see Georgios, I said, and certainly not the Admiral. Is there some place we can talk in private? The girl who eeped was peering out through the bead screen to the back of the suite. I already knew that she was smart enough to be dangerous. Gardein hesitated a moment, then he said, Come on, we'll go up to the roof. We went deeper into the bay, then up a circular metal staircase set into an alcove. I suspected the stairs had been salvaged from a starship's companionway. The trapdoor at the top was open, but Gardein clanged it closed when we stepped out onto a roof of tiles set in cement. Trees with short fuzzy trunks and broad foliage sat in pots in a rough circle around the trap, so that shade fell on the wicker couches and table, regardless of the time of day or year. Go away, Gardein said to the pair of attendants who'd been lounging in the shade. He made shooing motions with his hands. They obediently sauntered toward the nearest of the five other potted oases visible. The fourth wing of the palace was a story higher than the front and sides, and it had a real wall around it instead of just curving. I remembered Georgios's warning about the wives section and quickly looked at a tree. "Say what you want to say," Gardane snapped. I handed over my list, three sheets which I had been carrying rolled in my left hand. "Before we talk," I said, "I'd like you to read this." The cook scanned the first sheet, turned to the second, and finally the third. He looked at me. He must go to some effort to keep himself in shape, but he liked food too well to be completely successful at that. "It's a list of names," he said, working to stay calm. "What do they mean to you?" Keeping my voice emotionless, so that the words wouldn't sound like a threat, I said, "It's a list of people who are assigned to the Chamberlain's refectory, but who are also drawing rations from other divisions. And of people who are not members of the palace complement at all, but who are assigned to the Chamberlain's refectory. And of people who aren't people, non-existent people who are assigned to the Chamberlain's refectory." "I see," Gardane said. His eyes flicked in the direction of the guards whom he'd sent away. "What do you propose to do with this list?" "Absolutely nothing," I said. "I came to see you because I've been told that you have the authority to transfer my meal allowance to another palace division. In this case, I'd like you to transfer me and the boy Abram, and also the last four names on the list. People who didn't exist for any purpose except to draw rations, to the division of Chef Marshall. I believe his division generally handles gardeners and other outside workers, day laborers, many of them." Gardane's eyes went to the guards again. If he called to them, I was going to punch him in the stomach and fling open the trap door, hoping to get down the stairs before reinforcements arrived to throw me off the roof. "If I do that," Gardane said carefully, "what other business will you and I have? In particular, what will the Chamberlain himself have to say about it?" "Georgios will say nothing because he will know nothing," I said. "I am responsible for all data entry." "Agreed then," Gardane said. He smiled. "I suggest we go down and seal the bargain with a glass of wine." The wine wasn't bad. Abram had been right, though. Marshall seemed better. I was organizing the accounts, division by division. I hadn't thought of the Petersburg Chandlery as being very organized, but if I ever found myself back there, I would apologize for my previous sneers. The sneers hadn't reached my lips, and there was vanishingly small chance of me revisiting Petersburg Chandlery. For that matter, at the moment, things weren't looking good for me ever seeing Cinnabar again. I left the curtain open while I was working. There was a little air circulation that way, and the gang of household residents watching me weren't a problem after I'd gotten used to them. If they pushed too close, Abram chased them away with threats of what the Admiral's guards would do if they disturbed me. Initially, I thought the threats were just over-the-top hyperbole, but after a few days in the palace, I'd seen enough casual cruelty to fear that they were literally true. It was a thrumming bustle behind me, the way birds scatter when a hawk appears. The noise wasn't frightening, but the sudden silence that followed worried me. I turned to ask Abram what was going on. Abram wasn't there, but a pudgy man with a red turban, a cloth of gold tunic, and an entourage of three guards was. I'd never seen the Admiral, but I was pretty sure who this fellow was. I got up from the console, uncertain whether I was supposed to bow or maybe even throw myself on the floor. Sure, I'm a Cinnabar citizen and proud of it, but I'd already watched two people, a guy about my age and a kid of 10 or so, be impaled on stakes. I'm willing to die rather than do some things, but I'm not willing to die that way unless there really isn't a choice.
"Get out of here, you fool!"
a guard growled, jabbing his impeller at me. I jumped clear and whisked around the partition into Georgios's bedroom. There'd usually have been an attendant there to keep underlings out, but that fellow had vanished when the Admiral arrived. The Chamberlain was alone in his big bed. He'd awakened, probably when his attendants fled. He swung his legs out, he was wearing a paisley shift, and gestured me to the back of the suite. We went out onto the gallery, and Georgios closed the door behind us. There was no one in sight.
"Did he say what he was looking for?"
Georgios whispered. "He didn't say anything," I whispered back. "A guard told me to get out. Does this happen often?"
"Not often," Georgios said. "He doesn't usually leave the wives' wing except on court days, and this is early."
Then he gasped and said,
"The computer was working, wasn't it? It wasn't a blank screen?"
"Console was fine," I said soothingly. It was nearly midday, which might have been early for the Admiral, come to think, as well as for his Chamberlain. I was going over the Treasury Division accounts. That led to an obvious segue, and I said, "What does the Admiral do with the Consul?" If he was checking the Treasury accounts, there were going to be more people on stakes shortly. I wasn't doing an audit, and I'd just started on the division anyway, but the corruption I'd found in household expenses was subtle compared to what I'd seen at a glance in the Chancellor's department. "I don't know," Giorgio said miserably. "Do you suppose he's checking on me?" I started to say, "Well, I'll tell you as soon as I look at the Consul history," but I decided to keep quiet about that. The Chamberlain certainly didn't know that the Consul logged usage, and I realized that the Admiral himself probably didn't. "I guess we'd better hope not," I said instead. Then, because Georgios was so rattled, I said, "I think for safety's sake, I'd better start contacting the vendors myself instead of you sending the orders by messengers. Heaven only knows what some of them would say under a little pressure."
"Oh, great God," Georgios said. "Do you really think so? Oh, great God."
I patted him on the shoulder. "It's going to be fine," I said. "I'll take care of it and we'll both be safe." I wouldn't be safe until I was gone from Ben Yusuf. I was pretty sure this would be a step toward getting me there. Chapter 20. I'd thought my first order of business would be to find Abram, but I heard his laugh, a cheerful bray, coming up from below several times while Georgios and I were chatting. I leaned over the gallery railing and saw the boy among the customers at Marshall's Diner. I could have shouted to him, but walking down the stairs didn't arouse general notice. That didn't necessarily make me safe, but keeping a low profile struck me as the better option. People who randomly whack the heads off flowers start with the tallest stems. There were plenty of randomly violent people in the Admiral's palace. When Abram saw me walking toward the diner, he waved and trotted to meet me.
"Hey, boss," he said. "Glad you don't need a steak to stay upright. How's Georgios?"
"The same when I left him," I said. "He may need to change his trousers. Though come to think, he was still in his nightshirt. Still, it seemed like a good time to get out into the town. Take me to Balian's to begin with."
"We have an order for Balian?" Abram said. "He usually gives me a glass of wine when I bring him an order."
"I'll talk with Balian," I said. "There'll be others today, and more later, too." I planned to come away with more than a glass of wine. Marshall had kept me supplied with as much as I needed in piaster coins. He'd still be making a nice profit on the 6 mouths I'd transferred to his roster. But I thought it was time that I started making my own way. Abram led. I made an effort to recall the turns, but I wasn't very concerned about it. I'd be just as happy to have a companion every time I wandered the city. I could get Georgios to assign armed guards, I suppose, but I trusted Abram and his wits to stand me in as good stead as any of the guards I'd seen thus far. They seemed to be village boys who'd been handed a weapon. They might be brave enough, but they had the intelligence of the goats they'd been herding before they entered Salaam. Abram turned into a plaza around a sprawling building with white walls. The walls were less than 10 feet tall, but I could see that the roof was covered by a series of vaults. As soon as we stepped inside, keepers of the shops inside greeted us with noisy enthusiasm. They came from behind their counters, often with a selection of their wares hanging from one outstretched arm. Those in this neighborhood seemed to be jewelers, offering chains and bangles hanging from chains.
"We want hardware," Abram explained to me in a dismissive tone.
"That is," his expression grew cunning, "unless you've changed your mind about a girl. Murat in the last shop down is my friend and he can give you a good price." "I haven't changed my mind," I said, keeping my eyes straight ahead, despite the fingers plucking my sleeves. Do they treat everybody this way? Because Abram and I certainly weren't dressed to impress people with our wealth. We continued through to a cross bay and turned right. This time the shop sold low-end clothing, the local equivalent of the spacer's slops I was wearing. I could use more garments, but not now. For that matter, my inclination was to let Abram shop for my personal needs. I preferred to bargain at a higher level. Beyond the clothing was a hardware market. The shopkeepers were mostly male, as they had been in the jewelry bay, but they were less boisterously enthusiastic. The garment sellers had been women. Balian was an old man seated at the back of the shop. At the counter were two younger men. One wasn't much older than Abram. They cheerfully greeted him, taking him by the arms and drawing him past the counters of pipe fittings and into the racks of tools. I'd intended to have lists with me when I began visiting shopkeepers, but the Admiral's arrival hadn't given me time to plan. I'd recently gone over hardware purchases, though, so I figured I was current enough for the present purposes.
And this one, said the older of the youths, eyeing me without pleasure. You're training to be the new messenger?
The words were harmless. The insult was in the tone. Not exactly, I said. The acoustics in this large hall were designed for drinking clatter, rather than for transmitting speech clearly. But I could see that the old man in back was listening intently. I pitched my voice for him.
I'm the Chamberlain's assistant and have sole control of the console. I'm here to discuss future orders, rather than to place one today.
The younger clerk sniffed. Well, I guess we can stand a second glass of wine, he said loudly. I looked over his head at Balian and smiled. It wasn't a good-humored smile. I didn't speak, which seemed to put the boy off his stride. The old man got up and said,
Mehmet, why don't you and Suleiman attend our friend Abram? I will take the new gentleman. Your name, sir?
Royal Fetri, I said, nodding slightly.
Our new friend Roy into my office, Balian said.
To me, he added, it's quieter, and perhaps I could find a better bottle of wine.
I'm not here for wine, I said, as I followed him toward the back of the shop.
No, I didn't think you were,
Balian said sadly. He opened a door to which a rack of small metal fittings hung. They tinkled when the panel moved.
Well, what can a poor man do?
The office was small but antiseptically clean. One small desk, two straight chairs, and a four-drawer file cabinet. The old man opened the bottom drawer of the cabinet and came out holding an earthenware bottle and two shapely tulip glasses. He looked up and paused.
Unless perchance you'd like something stronger.
Ben Yusuf wine is quite strong enough for me, I said. Balian handed me a glass and closed the bottle with a plug of waxed wood. When he'd settled into his chair with the second glass, he eyed me and said,
Not bad, don't you think?
Yes, I agreed after a taste. But as I said, I'm not here for the refreshment.
Of course, Balian said. What proposition do you have for me, Royal Fetri?
For every 20 items ordered for the palace, I said, you invoice 21 as delivered. I enter the 21 and you and I split the billed amount of the 21st. You pay over my share in cash the next time I come by.
Indeed, said the old man, speaking with no inflection.
And what would you do, Royal Fetri, if I reported this conversation to Georgios, your master?
I shrugged. I think he'd be pleased, I said, at least when I explain that your pique is natural, given that I moved all the hardware purchases to Aja.
He agreed to pay a 25% commission to the Chamberlain instead of 20, you see.
Aja won't pay 25%,
Balian snarled, the first time his mask had slipped. I shrugged again. I suspect he will if I double his volume, I said. For a moment, Balian stared at me with an expression as blank as a pearl. Then he chuckled and said,
You know, you might be right about that, but...
His eyes hard focused again.
You haven't actually done that yet?
You were my first stop, I said truthfully. As best as I could tell, your prices are better than Ajah's. While the well-being of my employer, my owner, I suppose I should say, isn't my only consideration, I did take it into account.
Balian chuckled again. He set his glass down on the desk and laughed harder.
It didn't hurt me, but neither did the business seem to me such a funny joke. I said, Where do you get your supplies? Are there factories elsewhere on Ben Yusuf? Because I haven't seen much sign of them in Salaam.
Pipe and fittings are mostly made on planet, the old man said, sobering. There's an extrusion plant in the west suburbs here. Hand tools, some on Ben Yusuf. There's a couple factories in Eski Marrakesh. Power tools, they're all from off-planet.
I thought of what Georgios had said when he brought me to the palace.
I said, I didn't realize Ben Yusuf had off-planet trade.
Charities on other planets buy back their citizens under truce, Balian explained. That's mostly done in Eski Marrakesh. But my agent there buys on my orders and ships them to me.
He lifted the wine bottle.
Another? He said.
Not for me, I said, getting to my feet. But I'll be sending Abram with a formal order in a few days, once I've checked my records on the console.
That wasn't all I'd be checking on the console. I hoped the Admiral was finished by now. I was looking forward to learning what he'd been doing. I let Abram check on the Admiral's whereabouts. I didn't want to be seen asking about him or about much of anything. That was largely my plan of keeping a low profile, but I'd seen from our first meeting that Abram would get better information than I could. He knew so much that his quick brain could cross-check whatever people told him, and nobody was going to ask why he wanted to know something. Abram was always working an angle. If you stayed on his good side, you wouldn't find that angle jabbing you in the dark some night. The Admiral had only stayed 20 minutes before going back to the women's wing with his entourage of guards and toadies. None of them were permitted to watch what he was doing at the console. As before, I had Abram shoo the spectators off to a distance, though there hadn't been any reason for that except that I didn't want to be jostled. Less than half of the palace staff were even literate, and all I was doing at the computer was my job as the Chamberlain's assistant. I didn't intend to discuss with the Chamberlain what I was doing, sure, but he was probably happier not to know. I checked the usage log and found that all the Admiral's activity had been in areas accessed after insertion of a chip key. That dissociated them from the console's normal routines. The only way around that was to create an identical key, impossible for me and probably impossible for anybody else unless they had the original to copy, or to reset the console itself and to wipe all security formatting. That too was impossible unless you had the console's password, which could be set to 14 digits of letters, numbers, and symbols. In the RCN, every console was given a password generated by cosmic ray impacts. I'm sure the Alliance used a similar system. As consoles came from the manufacturer, though, the normal default was the last three digits of the unit's serial number. The Palace console was ex-commercial. As I suspected, keying in A3 asterisk opened all sectors of the console to me. There were document files which could be updated by information transferred when the key was inserted. That had been done regularly, but there had been no changes in the past month. Each was a personnel file, so to speak. The name of a woman, particulars of height, weight, and identifying characteristics, and where applicable the name of her father and her birth village, with the bride price. In five cases, the file gave the woman's name and planet of origin, with no mention of bride price. Four of those women did have prices listed, but with the name of a captain rather than a father. They'd been bought at slave auctions. The unique item on the list was Monica Smith, a blonde from Saguntum. She was the most recent arrival from 3 months back. No source or price appeared. That was a puzzle with no obvious means of solution. The sectors which the Admiral had been checking a few minutes ago were displays for observation cameras in the wives' wing, though I had to check the sources to be sure of that. I blanked the display in sudden terror, then turned on the couch. The console was in an alcove. 10 or 12 palace servants sat in a loose semicircle out in the gallery. They were staring at my back. They didn't seem concerned or even interested when I looked at them. Between me and them squatted Abram, with a double-edged dagger in his lap. Nobody was close enough for the point of the dagger to reach, quite, if Abram suddenly started swiping at spectators. I made sure the focus of my holographic display was set so that the images cohered only from within 16 centimeters, the unit was of Karst manufacture, of where my eyes were when I sat at the console. I took a deep breath and opened one of the camera feeds. I was looking at a woman with lovely blonde hair, about as old as I am. She was staring at a window covered by a carved wooden screen. The screen was a marvel of workmanship. The craftsman who'd made it could have earned a fortune on Cinnabar, turning out one-off masterpieces for newly rich gentlemen in Xenos. People like my dad had been. The blonde was in a corner room. I judged that she was looking over the alley on the south side of the palace. I doubted whether she could see the pavement, and I wasn't sure that she could even see the tops of the two-story buildings across the way. The screen was finger-thick, and the openings were narrow swirls an inch or two long. The blonde got up from the window ledge. Her expression was the only part of her that wasn't lovely. It was as cold as polished granite, not ugly but inhuman. There was only one blonde in the Admiral's records, so this was Monica Smith. Monica picked up a long-necked stringed instrument and walked to the door. I lost her when she went out, but there were more than 20 other feeds. I cycled through them until one gave me a large bay, probably the central half of the wing. 8 women lounged there. 2 were playing a game with cards and tiles. 3 sat at another table and drank small cupfuls from an urn. And the final 3 read or stared at wood-screened windows, much as Monica had been doing in her room. The camera installation had been expert. It covered the entire top floor of the wing and showed the interiors of every chamber. The feeds must have come from extreme fisheye lenses, but there was no distortion in what I saw because the console's enormous capacity easily corrected the images. I wondered who had installed and connected the equipment, and I wondered also if they had long survived the task. it was possible that the work had been done by women or by eunuchs. My suspicion after my past experience with the palace was that the admiral had bought slaves with the necessary expertise and then had executed them. The women were all dressed in loose garments and slippers. Monica wore a shift, much like the one Giorgio slept in, though hers was white instead of patterned. Most of the others were in similar garments or skirts and blouses, though one of the game players wore only a bandeau above the waist. Monica walked to a woman reading. They moved to a bench without back or arms and sat. Monica began to play while the other woman watched her fingering intently. Another woman entered the hall from a door which had been closed until then. The observation cameras didn't have sound, and I wouldn't have dared use it anyway, but the room full of women started as suddenly as birds raised by a gun dog. The newcomer was older than most of the others, mid-40s I would guess, but in very good condition. She was plumper than my taste, but that seemed to be the norm for Ben Youssef. The only slim adult woman whom I'd seen here was Monica. The woman who'd been sitting with Monica disappeared into one of the rooms. She left behind the book she'd been reading. Monica stood also, but she didn't back away. The admiral's chief wife was Azul, 50 years old and born on Ben Youssef. I was certain now that I was watching her, though she wore her age well. I couldn't hear the words the two women exchanged, but I could read them easily enough in the postures and expressions. Azul advanced. Instead of backing away, Monica picked up a lamp of turned brass from the table where her instructor had been reading. Azul halted. The older woman was dressed with greater formality than the other wives. Her long pale blue dress was cinched at the waist with a broad belt of leather dyed a darker blue, which matched the material of her cutwork slippers. Her hair fell loose on the right side, but was gathered by a gaudy beret on the left. Azul looked over her shoulder. A moment later, two men wearing pantaloons and loose blouses joined her. They were thick-bodied and soft-looking, but they were also big. One spoke to Azul, then they moved on Monica from either side. For a moment, I thought the girl was going to fight them. Then she hurled the lamp to the floor and handed the musical instrument to the man, the eunuch, obviously, on her right. That servant carried the instrument to Azul, bowed, and handed it over. The other eunuch shifted slightly, so that he was directly between the women. He continued to watch Monica. Azul examined the instrument. The sound box was very small compared to the long neck. She walked to the outside wall where Monica could see her clearly. Raising the instrument in both hands, as though she were using an axe, she swung it against the masonry. It shattered into scraps of light wood and the sturdier neck from which the four strings dangled. Azul tossed the neck to the floor. She turned and walked back into the room she had appeared from. Monica said nothing. She too returned to her room. She closed her door with a controlled motion instead of banging it. I blanked my display. I was trembling inside. Then after a moment, I reopened the feed I had started with, the interior of Monica's room. It was the last one the admiral had been watching. Monica lay on her bed, her face buried into the bedclothes. Judging from the way her body shook, she was sobbing. I turned off the console. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do just now, but I knew I didn't want to see more of the internal politics of the wives' wing. I was at work on the dry goods accounts as best as I could. It was a tangled mess, with minimal data entered. Usually a gross amount and uncertain dates. At least a third of the entries were identical to the sous to one or more other entries. That didn't necessarily mean they were false, however, because it was the nature of housekeeping expenses to be repetitive. I'd have been right more often than not to say an account was false, though. It's not just that Ben Youssef existed by piracy. Its society was corrupt from bottom to top. I wasn't taking a moral stance to think that it should be remade. That was just a pragmatic assessment. Abram rang a brass triangle right behind me. I jumped, but it had been my idea. When I was working, I tuned out my surroundings. That was fine for most things, but if I ignored the admiral when he visited, I was likely to be alerted by a guard using the butt of his impeller. I blanked the display before I turned around. There was nothing wrong with me going over household accounts, but I might have been viewing the wives' wing. I was training myself to react the safe way every time. I didn't want either gelding or impaling to become part of my work history. Abram stood with Law, my shipmate from Captain Hakim's crew. I surprised myself with how glad I was to see him. Lal and Abram were the closest thing to friends I'd made since I was shanghaied on Saguntum. "Say, Spacer," I said, getting up from the console. My eyes had to adjust before I could see him properly. "What are you doing here?" "Well, when we landed at Salam, I thought I'd see how you were getting on," Lal said, looking around. "I thought you'd be all right, but I'm still surprised that you're doing this well. From what I hear, you're running things in the palace." "No, not that," I said truthfully. I didn't add, "And if it were true, I wouldn't say it. Even Georgios doesn't find me so indispensable that he wouldn't have somebody knife me if he decided I was a danger to him." Aloud, I went on, "Have you had lunch? Let me buy you lunch." "I wouldn't mind," Lal said. "We made a couple decent captures this time, but Captain Hakim won't be paying off till the auction in a week or so." I looked at Abram and made a quick calculation. "Abram," I said, "let's you and I find a place we can have lunch with my old shipmate. Some place the food's as good as Marshall's, but where we don't have to stand outside."
"Right," said Abram. "I really like Etzel's down by the harbor, if you don't mind a bit of a walk."
We didn't mind. "Of course." I heard people say, "You've got to trust somebody," and I've also heard them say, "You can't trust anybody." Neither of those things is true. Both are just words that people shout when a plan or a relationship goes belly up. I've known people who didn't seem to trust anybody. My dad was one of them. Certainly neither my brother nor I had any notion of how he was getting his contracts. As for Mom, I don't doubt that she was just as shocked as she seemed when the investigators and the bailiffs descended on us. But by the same token, none of Dad's business associates betrayed him. He was unmasked when a new Minister of Defense took over, and for her own political purposes, forced a really serious audit. But that was the thing. Dad had lost, I don't know a better word for what had happened, despite not trusting anyone. And I simply didn't want to live that way. Sure, I could go off with Lal on my own, without arousing suspicion in anybody but Abram himself, and maybe not even in him. He might be able to help, though. And anyway, I just wanted to let him know what I was thinking. Etzel's was a narrow frontage between a pair of large shops catering to spacers with clothing, cheap jewelry, and personal weapons. Etzel had a satellite location, though, a combination of marquee and shed on an outcrop closer to the water. A sheet of structural plastic formed a floor flat enough for chairs, but because of the rock, nobody came ashore there. We took a table and were waited on by a boy younger than Abram. When he had scampered back to the main building to fetch our wine and food, I first nodded to Abram, then said to Lal, "I want to get off planet."
"I'd say you were sitting pretty," Lal said. "Why would you want to leave?"
"He doesn't belong here," said Abram unexpectedly. "There's some from the big worlds that really take to it. Guido, the war chief, he's from Pantelleria, and the vizier of Eski Marrakesh is from Plaisance itself. But Roy here," he nodded to me, "is scheming to get away. And some other stuff, too. I shouldn't wonder. He'll lose his wedding tackle if he's not lucky."
I didn't say anything, but my heart was a block of ice.
"Well, you're out of luck if you think one of the captains is going to sign you on," Lal said to me. "Even Hakim. He'd have been glad to have you before, but now that you're the Admiral's slave, he won't touch you. He wouldn't be able to come back to Salam if he did. And even if he was willing to lift out of someplace else, it wouldn't do you any good. The Admirals all stick together that much. They won't harbor each other's run slaves."
"What about other planets?" I said. My hopes were melting. I could pay well.
"Where do you suppose a ship from Ben Yusuf could land, and not everybody aboard be hanged?" Lal said. "I don't know of any place."
Our orders came. The food was a thick fish stew, spread on a trencher of barley bread. We ate with spoons in our hands. It was the best meal I'd had on Ben Yusuf, and I'm not complaining about Marshall's food.
"If you had enough money," Abram said, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, "you could buy a ship."
"And then what?" said Lal. "Oh, sure, Roy could captain it and maybe work it alone. I don't believe that, but maybe he could. But where's he going, then? To Blanchard or St. Julian? They'd more likely shoot him when he opened the airlock than they'd start cheering about his escape. If it's a bigger place that has a guard ship, you won't get out of orbit."
"Yeah," said Abram, without the animation of a moment before. "Anybody arriving on a cutter from Ben Yusuf is a pirate when he reaches anywhere else." That's not what I wanted to hear, I said, scraping a spoonful of sop bread from my trencher. I think I sounded calm. I sounded calmer than I felt, anyway.
Look, said Lal, if I knew a way, I'd tell you. You saved my life, Roy. I'll do anything I can for you.
Boss, I don't want you to leave Salaam, believe me, Abram said earnestly. But you'll die if you stay here. I won't turn you in, but somebody will. So you better get out or quit looking at the wives. And I don't know how you can get out.
Etzel's wine wasn't very good, but we drank a lot more of it before Lal went off to his room, and Abram led me to the palace. On the way back, I said, Abram, why do you think I've been looking at the place he said? I didn't want to use the words. I didn't think anybody passing in the street would hear enough to be a problem, but I'd been sure that nobody could see the display when I was using it.
Abram looked at me. Look, boss, I didn't know what you were doing, and I figured I ought to, he said. The way you were acting, there was more than just money.
He grinned.
You don't care about money, he said. You could make a lot more easy, but you don't bother.
I suppose that's true, I said. But how did you see a display that was focused just for me?
I rigged a mirror on the pillar in front of me, Abram said. I watched your fingers move. I can't read, but I'm good on motion. And when you were asleep, I did what you'd been doing. If anybody'd asked, I'd have said I was doing it for you, but nobody asked. But when I got the place you mostly went to...
He put his hand on my arm and stopped me where we were, 20 feet from the gate of the palace. In an even softer voice than before, he continued.
I glanced at it and then I shut down. I never want to see that again. No matter how bad Georgios needs you, he'll have you impaled, and probably me too if he ever gets a whiff of what you're doing.
I took a deep breath. I'm sorry, Abram, I said. If you want to get a long way away from me before anything happens, I won't blame you. But I'm not going to quit. And I'm going to get her away with me, somehow.
Chapter 21
I'd say that the lunch with Lal had changed my life, but it really didn't. It just sort of reinforced my plan to keep on doing things the way I was, particularly about trusting Abram. The worst Georgios and the Admiral would do if Abram told them I was planning to escape would be to put me in shackles. But if Abram had told them what he'd figured out on his own, that I was spying on the wives, my punishment wouldn't have stopped till I was dead. I kept watching the wives, but mostly I kept watching Monica. She didn't belong as the Admiral's wife any more than I belonged as his slave. Maybe that was part of what was eating at me about Monica, the fact we were unfairly in the same boat. But I don't kid myself that I'd have thought about her so much if she'd been old and ugly. I try to be a person I can smile at when I look in the mirror, but I never wanted to be a saint. There was plenty of work to do. I was combining the week's food order. I wouldn't put it all with the same broker, but bulk still gave me more leverage than I'd have had otherwise. When Abram brought me into the present by ringing the triangle, I shut down and turned as the Chamberlain entered the gallery. I didn't see Georgios very often, except when he was passing through, to and from his own apartments. He was so willing to leave the console to me that he didn't seem to look at it.
"We've bought a lemon tree," he said, sounding flustered. "It's being delivered this afternoon."
I'd gotten up, clearing the couch for Georgios. "Yes, sir," I said politely. I couldn't imagine why he was upset by a purchase which didn't sound particularly major. Nobody'd submitted an invoice yet, so I couldn't be quite sure of that.
"It's for the wives' garden," Georgios said. "The Admiral will be here shortly to unlock the alley entrance. Is the console working properly?"
"It's working perfectly," I said. "I was just checking the food orders, but there's no rush on that."
"Oh, thank the great God," said Georgios. "I'm always afraid that it will fail again and I'll be blamed."
"I'll keep out of the way then," I said calmly. I didn't know there was an alley entrance. I bowed to Georgios, then slipped through what was left of the usual gathering of spectators. Most of them had disappeared as soon as they'd heard that the Admiral was coming. Abram followed without me needing to call him. I'm not sure whether he was coming with me or just dodging the Admiral. "Let's see Marshall," I said, though what I really meant was let's go outside. When we got through the main entrance, Abram gestured to the left. Marshall's diner would have been to the right.
"I figured you wanted to know about the alley entrance," Abram said. "There's a bit of a plaza at the end of the alley. There's a common well.
That'll let us watch without, you know, getting caught up in it.
I'm glad you're on my side, I said. That was the truth if I'd ever spoken it. There were lots of people in the plaza, which was a flagstone triangle, with a street on one side, and the sides of buildings built askew on the other two. There wasn't any furniture, but a pair of local trees grew in terracotta pots, which were as sturdy as the dry stone well curb. We sat on the edge of a pot, and Abram began trimming the callus on his left heel with his long knife. The three men who'd been standing nearby moved away.
"They're house slaves," he said. "They're just here with the women."
He nodded in the direction of the well, where heavily bundled up women stood gossiping.
"Down the alley there is where they'll be bringing in the tree."
Six guards with impellers and wearing edged weapons stood in the middle of the narrow passage. They were led by an officer wearing a fur cap, above which nodded a long feather dyed bright blue.
"There's a tunnel through the wing and into the little garden just for the wives," Abram said. "There's no door through the wall between the courtyard and the wives' garden. Food and stuff you can bring into the wing through the regular passages, but this is a tree."
A pair of motorized platforms came up the street from the direction of the bay. They looked like the one Georgios used when he went out, but they were linked back to back. A tree with a cloth-wrapped root ball rode the join. Men stood on either side, bracing the trunk with their hands. "I wonder why the Admiral uses the cameras to watch what he could be right there in person watching," I said. I had wondered, and this was a chance to discuss it with the one person on Ben Yusuf I could do that with. Abram snorted.
"Hey, he's getting on," he said. "He's fat, he drinks, and he's bored. I don't guess the wives get much personal attention, though you'd know that better than me. If he can't do it himself, he can still get a kick out of peeping at what the women get up to on their own." I thought about it.
"I suppose," I said. Certainly, the Admiral didn't visit any of his wives' rooms often. I didn't watch what happened during those visits, but from the determination with which several of the women tried to entice him, he wasn't terribly interested in sex. Georgios arrived from the other end of the alley. When he gave an order, a guard grasped the door handle. It was a U of reinforcing rod, welded onto the metal door, and tugged. Another guard joined him before the panel started to open, but it took a third man to actually haul it fully back. The crew who'd arrived with the tree lifted it down on its wooden framework, then carried it into the passage. There were half a dozen of them, but two carried shovels and a pick from the vehicle.
"There's another door on the garden end," Abram said. "Boutros, he's one of the geldings, he told me. There's no key lock, just the console that only the Admiral can work."
He looked at me and raised an eyebrow.
"Except maybe you can too, can you?" he added.
I shrugged. "I ought to be able to," I said. "I haven't looked for a lock control on the console, though." The guards and workmen finally came out of the passage. The last one was Georgios. I turned my head away, but Abram didn't bother to. The Chamberlain seemed to have paid attention only to the door as the guards forced it shut with a loud clang. The workmen rode off on their vehicle. Georgios and most of the guards waited near the closed door, but one man scampered past us and continued up the street toward the front of the palace.
"They've got to tell the Admiral to lock it again," Abram said. "I hear that some places they got radios to do that from a ways away. Is that true?"
"That's true," I agreed. Then I said, "Abram, would you be able to find me some penetrating oil in a pry bar?"
"Yeah," he said, "if you are crazy enough to want them."
I heard another clang from down the alley, sharper and lighter than that of the door itself being closed. This must have been the electronic bolt being shot home by the console. Georgios and the remainder of the guards walked off, going in the other direction. "I'm that crazy," I said. I wasn't going to do anything until I saw a way of doing everything I needed. It was a case of one step at a time, but most steps had to be in different directions rather than marching straight toward a goal. I daubed the three massive hinges of the alley door with penetrating oil, but then I re-entered the palace and hid the remainder of the can of penetrating oil in the framework from which Georgios' bed curtains hung. I could retrieve it easily there, but even if it were found, it didn't point to me. When Georgios next came past my alcove, I stopped him. "Sir," I said, "was the Admiral pleased with the way I've kept the console in operating condition?"
"Yes, everything went well," the Chamberlain said.
He looked a little worried, which is what I intended when I brought up the console and the fact it depended on me.
Good, I said. Good.
I want to attend the sale of slaves this afternoon, sir.
You do?
Giorgio said. His mild worry had risen to alarm. Ah, I suppose you're planning to buy a slave of your own. Slaves, perhaps?
I'm just considering possibilities, sir, I said. It was normal for slaves of some rank to own slaves themselves. Generally, it was a mark of status, though I'd run into cases where a slave official's slaves did all the official's work.
To make sure Georgios was getting the point, I said, I think I'll have to continue doing all the computer work, though. This console is remarkably finicky, and I regularly have to reset it when it locks up. I could never train somebody who could keep it going.
Well, there's no reason you shouldn't buy a slave, Georgios said.
Ah, and you can come to me if you need someone to guarantee your credit with the auctioneer. He strode quickly into his bedroom. I bowed respectfully to his back, then said to Abram,
Let's go watch an auction.
Suits me, Abram said. I don't know what you want a slave for.
I didn't. What I wanted was a look at, and just possibly a meeting with, the Karst Consul. Slaves were sold at the top of the swale near the underground prison. There were stone seats and a permanent roof of structural plastic for spectators. There was nothing for the prisoners, unless you counted the tower which mounted an automatic impeller. It was sighted on the backside of the bleachers, which struck me as odd until I realized that from this location, the muzzle couldn't be lowered enough to bear on the customers. Given the quality of the guards I'd seen in Salaam, that was a wise precaution. They'd started to bring out the prisoners by the time we arrived. They were in groups of five, roped together at the right ankle. Guards were linking them as they climbed a ladder from the pit. None of them looked in great shape, even without bonds, but I suppose the Admiral saw no reason to take chances. We climbed four levels of seats, above the audience already in place. Those seated on the bottom row had come with cushions. Two of the four principals had brought attendants.
The high mucky-mucks down there are the consuls, Abram whispered. That's Platform Karst on the right, and the woman on the left's Kimber or Kimley, something like that, from the Alliance. The two in the middle are the Solitan League and the Sworn Brotherhood. They're each three worlds, but they don't count for much.
The Alliance Consul was the only woman visible. Platt was taller than me, but he looked worn. His curly hair was obviously dyed and had receded high up his forehead. My first glance wasn't encouraging, but it seemed that he might be what I had to work with. I looked at the woman from the Alliance. There was no legal connection there, but maybe her gender would help? The thing was, I'd met plenty of women doing jobs that mostly were handled by men. From what I'd seen, and I was an outsider, I know, most of them were harder on other women than a man would have been. I guess they were just proving they weren't soft. The first gang of slaves shuffled in front of the stands. They were looking down and sometimes shielding their eyes with their hands. The roof didn't cover them.
Five spaces from the ship Hensau, the auctioneer called.
He was in the Chancellor's division, a man named Albert. I knew him slightly because he chose to buy meals from Marshall instead of eating with his own division.
All sound and limb.
Two men in the second row bid against one another without enthusiasm. The lot was sold at 120 piastres per person. Guards shuffled the slaves off to the other end, where groups of attendants waited. An aide to the successful bidder jotted notes, as did Albert's assistant.
They're both off-planet labor contractors, Abram explained. They're putting together gangs to ship out of Eski Marrakesh.
Another group was offered. This time an old man seated just below us with a grandson asked for a closer examination. He looked at the spacers, also from the Hensau, individually, demanding they open their mouths. He finally offered 200 piastres on the second man in line. No one bid against him, though the other labor contractor bought the remainder of the coffle at 110 apiece. These were men just like me. It bothered me a little that I was thinking of them as items of trade, as I would think of shovels or bags of barley being bought for the palace. I don't suppose it mattered. I wasn't buying them, even buying them for the palace. Georgios had an assistant to purchase labor. That fellow, Ali, son of Ali, wasn't present today. I said to Abram,
How about me?
I wasn't paraded like those fellows.
Oh, I heard about that, he said. That was really hush-hush, you know? Georgios did a deal with the cutter's captain, who took you, cash under the table. The Chancellor didn't get his cut, but maybe Georgios squared him. Abram looked at me and grinned. I guess he had to pay pretty well to get an expert on the console like you, huh? He said.
I don't know what he paid, I said. It was off book like you figure, so I haven't found it in the records. I think he paid in Alliance Tollers.
I didn't argue about being called an expert on the console. In Salaam, that's what I was. The third group came up to bid. Albert hadn't more than stated.
5 spacers from the S-611 out of Rupert's planet,
when the tall man at the head of the line put his arms akimbo.
I am a citizen of Bryce, he called, looking from one console to the other. I'm being improperly held.
Albert turned to the woman.
Mistress Kimber, he said, this spacer was a member of the crew of S-611, which is registered on Rupert's planet. Salaam has no treaty with Rupert's planet.
That's a lie, said the spacer. I'm Gus Andre, and I was a passenger on S-611, not crew.
Master Albert, said the woman. Two of her aides were whispering together as one consulted his personal data unit. What evidence do you have that this man was crew and not a passenger?
The S-611 didn't have facilities for passengers, said Albert, pulling a hard copy document from his script. Just bunks for the crew.
I slept in a bunk, Andre said, but I wasn't crew.
Do you have the ship's log showing that Andre was enrolled in the crew? Kimber demanded.
I don't have record of that, no, Albert said.
Before the consul could speak again, Albert gestured to one of the escorting guards.
Release this man to the care of the Alliance consul.
An attendant separated the freed man from the rest of the coffle by using shears to snip the light rope which attached his ankle to a heavy hawser. He tried to run over to the consul with his arms outstretched, but one of her aides intercepted him and led him off to the side where attendants waited. Bidding began on the remainder of the coffle.
Are there any women? I asked Abram.
They're sold separately, he said. They're kept in that building with the yellow window frames.
He gestured back toward the town proper. The barred windows didn't set it off from other houses.
And the really pretty ones don't come to public auction anyway, Abram continued. The Chancellor holds a private sale for high rollers. But say, look, if you want a woman, I can find you plenty of stuff that's just as good as what comes off captured ships. Except maybe hair color. Real blonde is hard, but I could keep an eye out.
Thank you, Abram, I said. But it was just curiosity. I like to know things, but I'm not looking for a woman.
If you've got problems with buying one, there's a lot of fathers I could introduce you to, Abram said. You're a big man, Roy, even though you don't put on side. There's a lot of girls who'd really like to be a woman.
Arguing with him didn't do any good, so I concentrated on the new line of prisoners shuffling in. The man in the middle was arguing with the guards. When he reached the display area, he called to the consuls.
I'm from Andover, and I was a passenger on the Regensveld. A passenger!
This man is Tom Burris, crewman on the Regensveld, out of Grantholm,
Albert said, reading from his hard copy.
He has spacer's tattoos.
Those aren't spacer's tattoos, Burris shouted. Ariel is my girlfriend, not a ship.
Well, she was. I've never been in space except as a passenger, and I was on my way back home when you bastards caught the Regensveld in orbit.
The consul for the sworn brotherhood got to his feet and said,
Master Albert, tattoos are common on Andover. There's nothing about Master Burris's tattoo to suggest he's anything but a healthy young man with a girlfriend.
Albert glanced at his hard copy again, then looked up and said,
Appeal denied. 5 spacers, 1 missing 3 fingers of his left hand. What am I offered?
I protest, the consul shouted.
You can't do this, said Burris.
Albert said nothing to the consul. To the nearest guard, he said,
Silence the prisoner so that I can get on with the auction.
The guard had a thick-bladed cutlass instead of an impeller. He chopped at Burris's head with the flat. The prisoner got his hands up, but the edge scraped his forearm. He staggered back and fell. The guard moved forward, but Albert said,
That's enough, to the consul, he added. You can make a protest to your government if you like. When the auction closes, I'll give you a note as to where the man has been sold for you to pursue it if you like.
The sale proceeded. I said to Abram, I don't see how Albert could be so certain. A tattoo doesn't seem much evidence the fellow was a crewman. Abram shrugged and said,
The Sworn Brotherhood has maybe 3 gunboats and a very old destroyer if they get everything together. The consul would have to send the message off through Eski Marrakesh, which would take a good month, whereas the Alliance could have a standby squadron here in 6 weeks and stay long enough to screw everybody on Ben Yusuf's life up. They wouldn't land troops himself.
but they might make it hot enough for the other admirals to make a change in who was running Salaam.
I see, I said. As the next coffer was arriving, I tapped Abram on the arm. I guess I've seen enough, I said. We got up and headed back for the palace. The delivery from Roussel should be made.